The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Happy Friday, everyone, and welcome to Squawk Box. Here are your headlines. U.S. producer prices come in softer than expected, rising by just 0.2% and easing some concerns over sticky inflation. The Nasdaq rallies to a fresh record, with Apple posting its best day in nearly a year, while Amazon hits a new all-time high.
Morgan Stanley's shares sink on a report. The bank's wealth management unit is being probed by multiple regulators. This comes as U.S. banks prepare to kick off the first quarter earnings season today.
And German industrial giant ThyssenKrupp says it could slash steel production by as much as a fifth. Wow. Whilst warning of job cuts to come at a key plant. Good morning, good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to my two-day week next week.
Are you?
Yeah.
And you and I know what we're joking about here.
Yeah, well it's an amazingly big week you've got. We'll just hold that off for a bit, but I'm very excited for you. It's going to be very, very exciting. Let me go through the PPI data, because it was finally a piece of data out of the States that some of those interest rate doves can go, well, look, I told you, it wasn't that bad. I mean, it wasn't amazing, but it was better than some expected. So, US PPI data came in softer than expected in March, rising by 0.2% on the month. The smallest gain since December. Now, on an annual basis, wholesale prices rose by 2.1%. The report comes after Wednesday's hotter-than-expected consumer inflation print, which saw markets reprice the timing of the Fed's first rate cut this cycle. And you're going to go through the markets, and I'm assuming one of the highlights is the fact that the Nasdaq is at a record high. But I thought to myself, we've had, in the last five trading days, to contend with huge... unambiguous. I mean, you and I can't argue this. Huge jobs data. Really unimpressive CPI data for those who want rate cuts as well. And yet, the Nasdaq, which, do you remember those days when we said, oh, it's really interest rate sensitive? This is when we reinvented the rhetoric, because everyone said, oh, it's structural, it doesn't matter about interest rates. But then they reinvented it and said, oh, it's all about discounted cash flows going forward. So it's really interest rate sensitive. And yet, given all that that's been thrown, rate cuts off the table for now. The Nasdaq's at a record high. Isn't that amazing?
Well, there has been some interest rate sensitivity this week, right? We could see a little bit of it expressed through the Dow, but particular sectors, real estate was one area that was under a bit of pressure this week. You've seen it at various different points over the banks as well. So I think there's been an element of churn around that monetary policy re-rating. This time the market now pushing out those rate cut expectations. So what do you do in that context? Well, I think we've gone back to the old playbook. A lot of market participants, again, looking at the AI technology story. So almost perversely, even though we're talking about high credit costs for longer, which typically would have knocked technology, I think now there's a view that there's technology and there's technology. Yeah. And that extra part is that, look, let's just chase AI. It's a different story on its own trajectory. And, you know, you've got a lot of companies trying to get in the game and doing different things. Apple was the latest. There's been a lot of criticism. I've put my hand up as one of the critics too, that thinks Apple's been a bit slow getting into the AI game. Yeah. Bit more news flow around the Mac product line yesterday and AI, which drove the stock.
You and I've had this conversation many times. I won't pick you up on the Apple thing, because we've done that too many times. But yeah, I just think it's amazing what happened to the rotation then. If everyone's going back into tech, what happened to the endless legion of guests we've had said, oh, it's now time for a bit of rotation? Well, that didn't show it.
Yeah, I was talking to Bob Parker the other day, and he was saying to us, look, it's going to be a frustrating year. Yeah. I think that highlights you're getting a lot of change, a lot of churn, rotation back, and then not too much change at an index level, which makes it very hard if you're not in this market. But speaking of markets, let me take you to the boards and what we saw in that trade yesterday. That NASDAQ record, as you can see, it came with a fairly decent percentage push higher, but 1.7% pop, and to the tune of 270-odd points in the green. But in that context, we did see the Dow flat in session with a slight red tilt. So the market just showing a little bit of weakness in that area. And over the course of the trading week, similar picture. Dow down about 1.1% so far for the trading week versus the NASDAQ that stretched out more gains with a pop of 1.2% for the trading trading week. In terms of the big stocks, and you can see the undercurrent for technology, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, those big US tech names, all in play yesterday. A fairly decent trade, you can see on the Apple stock, 4% to the upside. Certainly very strong numbers there. Alphabet up almost 2%. The one that I think the market was looking at too, commentary from Andy Jassy yesterday about the company's ambitions around AI, how it could be another pillar of growth for the company. And you can see that stock up 1.6% at an all-time high. So a lot of green back in the markets, particularly around Tesla, Alphabet, Amazon, Nvidia. I mean, these major names that a lot of investors have been keen to closely track this year. Tesla has in fact been the odd one out, but you can see back in with the rest of the pack yesterday. To what we're seeing elsewhere on treasuries, and it was that softer producer price number that came through yesterday, and that's been one of the markets watched before versus just the CPI to see what factory gate prices are doing to anticipate the next direction for disinflation. And the slightly softer picture there, welcome on the back of what has been fairly hot numbers coming through on the CPI, but also on the jobs report. So we've seen 4.94 sticking around that level roughly on the two-year yield. The 10-year, we're about 3 basis points off the 5%. So again, slightly higher from where we have been midweek. I want to take you to the dollar trade as a result, and that strength we've seen in the yield story has been very much underpinning the trade around the currency. Greenback again firmly on the front foot, sterling, euro both declining as a result, drifting off about a tenth of a percent. Messages yesterday from the ECB, strong signals that they are looking at cutting interest rates at the next meeting in June. Some actually arguing for sooner rate cuts at the meeting. So you can see that softness, 107.11 on euro dollar. Dollar yen, again, we're still watching for intervention, aren't we? 153.22 as we continue to see that softness in the Japanese currency. To the Asian markets, and the Friday trade is a little bit mix. You've got a fairly decent day playing out across in Japan, thanks to picking up on that lead from Wall Street and the big technology names. We've got a bounce on big stocks in Tokyo, but elsewhere, a fade on Hong Kong. It is down about 1.6%. Slight drop on stocks out of China and Australia. Trades down by about 30 odd points, or 0.4%, Steve.
Cheers, Karen. A trio of Fed officials. Let me go back a bit. I spoke to Mohamed El Erian the other day, and he said the problem with the Fed at the moment is we're getting less medium-term strategy and more play-by-play commentary.
Jawbone.
I know there's no rule against them talking constantly through every single bit of data, but I don't know how much it helps. I don't know how much it helps get coherent over what the longer-term plan is.
Well, can I argue that? So, for a long time with monetary policy, when you've seen policymakers not want to use the toolkit, they've used jawboning as a very effective tool to try and guide the markets. And you think if you get tighter...
Isn't that what we've got Doppler for?
Well, if you get tighter financial market conditions thanks to jawboning, doesn't it mean you get the chance that the toolkit actually gets used sooner rather than later, versus if they're all talking about some weakness coming through in inflation, they're all sort of sitting around consensus, the three rate cuts. Does that mean it's less likely to get the three because you've got slightly looser financial conditions?
Fair enough. Yeah, it just kind of made me think, then this next week, I haven't even read it, and I just saw this this comment. A trio of Fed officials pushed back against the need for rate cuts in the near term overnight after Wednesday's hotter than expected CPI print saw traders reprice their bets on the Fed's path. New York Fed President John Williams said there is no clear need to adjust rates in the very near term, whilst the Richmond Fed President Thomas Barkin said the latest data did not increase his confidence that inflation is returning to targets. Boston Fed President Susan Collins said that while she does expect rate cuts this year, she's also concerned about sticky inflation.
I do expect to see further evidence that inflation is durably, if unevenly, returning to 2%, and that the economy is coming into better balance with demand and supply more closely aligned amid a healthy labor market. And as a result, I do expect that it will be appropriate to begin lowering the federal funds rate, but later this year. However, in addition to that optimism, I'm also realistic about the risks and the uncertainties which remain elevated. Recent data suggests that it may take more time than I had previously thought to gain greater confidence in inflation's downward trajectory before beginning to ease policy.
Shares in Morgan Stanley closed over 5% lower after the Wall Street Journal reported that the company's wealth management arm is being investigated by several regulators. The SEC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and other Treasury Department officers are reportedly probing the unit over whether it sufficiently reviews clients over money laundering risks. The report added that some of the bank's international clients are being examined.
I'm just looking at Arab Bidet's wall. My goodness me, those numbers. He'll do it in a moment, but something's really struck out for me. First quarter earnings season set to kick off today. Three major Wall Street lenders reporting. Arab Bidet, that wall, something really strikes me. And I don't want to steal your thunder of where you're going to go, and I don't know where you're going to go. But the earnings slowdown, the earnings recession, it's non-existent. Look at the Q2, the 3, and then the Q4 expectations.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's a moderate start, or modest start, as you will, right? But certainly progressively getting better across the year in many ways. We're gearing up for that first quarterly earnings season of 2024. Analysts being more optimistic than they were actually heading into last year. For the full year, earnings per share then across the S&P 500 are expected to grow 9.8%. Now, this figure would be more than double the 4.1% that was expected as we entered 2023. It is according, of course, to LSEG data. Now, earnings and revenue growth is expected to be positive in the first quarter, but analysts think we will see some of the weakest of the year, just 5%. In terms of quarterly earnings there. Now, it's all kicking off with some of the biggest banking names, of course, on Wall Street. We'll hear from JP Morgan, Citi, as well as Wells Fargo. That's happening today then, before getting results then out of Goldman Sachs as well then on Monday. Then Morgan Stanley and the Bank of America coming out next week. Now, all three of the major banks reporting today are expected to see an earnings slide. JP Morgan, earnings per share are seen falling. That's around 4%, so 3.88, as you can tell, year on year. 4.15 is where you're pretty much seeing that. Now, while larger declines are expected at Citi, as well then as Wells Fargo. Citi getting a big decline there of more than 30%. Trading weakness is expected to weigh on lenders, as well as increased loan provisioning, with interest rates set to remain higher. But one source of optimism could come from net interest income. We're expecting a mixed picture for the first quarter, particularly from the lenders here reporting today specifically. But all eyes will be on the guidance, with falling expectations from Fed rate cuts potentially boosting the outlook for the rest of the year, Steve.
Many thanks. Octavia Morenzi's joined us, CEO of Opimas. Octavia, before we look forward to the US earnings, and good morning to you, sir. I want to look backwards a little bit as well. Karen and I had one of our exquisite little arguments yesterday, and I did love it immensely, talking about European banks versus US banks, UBS, the size of it now, outsized for Switzerland, but actually not outsized compared to its US peers. I think that encapsulates a lot of what we said. Are we destined to be in this slow, non-global lane in Europe, given the attitude of the Swiss government yesterday to UBS?
I mean, in terms of the slow lane, what do you mean?
I tell you exactly what I mean. I mean that the European policymakers are so terrified about having big, powerful banks that they are determined to clip the wings of any bank that gets too big. And as such, as Sergio Motti's been saying, if we want to be able to compete with the US, we need the same rules, not more punitive rules as well. Given where policymakers are, given the lack of CMU, given the lack of banking integration and union in Europe as well, are we destined to have smaller, less global banks than the US?
Well, I think it's interesting. If you listen to the US banks, if you listen to someone like Jamie Dimon, they'll make the exact same argument in the other way. They basically said, if we were a European bank, we could do all sorts of things that we're not allowed to do and take all sorts of risks that we're not able to do. So this kind of argument seems to go both directions. We're US banks looking at European regulations and sort of cherry picking a bit and saying, if we were active in Europe, we could do things that we can't do here, and vice versa. I mean, in terms of the very large banks and too large to fail, I mean, yes, for Switzerland, UBS UBS has certainly become too big to fail. I mean, it's an absolute powerhouse within Switzerland and makes up for a substantial portion of Swiss GDP. But that is an animal of the Swiss government's creation. I mean, they quite deliberately merged together Credit Suisse and UBS, even though potentially there were other alternatives there. So there's all sorts of lip service to basically not allowing banks to get too big. But when push comes to shove, the governments have actually sort of forced these mergers and made these enormous behemoths, UBS being the best example of it. So there's some slight contradictions that are coming out from the banks themselves and from the regulators as well. And there are so many regulations that these banks face that it's very difficult to figure them all out. There's tens of hundreds of thousands of pages of regulations. And you can certainly look at some and say they're more favorable to business than others in each geography and region.
Oh, that's interesting. So, I mean, my word's not yours. Politicians talking out both sides of their mouth. Again, naming no politician, not defaming any individuals. Yeah, OK, interesting. OK, that said, and plus the fact I don't believe for 1 minute Jamie Dimon would like to work in Europe rather than on the US jurisdiction. But, well, I can raise that with Jamie on another occasion as well. In terms of how UBS goes forward, we just showed a chart. I think they're 2690 Swissy as well. What do you think of this bank in its current format?
I think it looks really good. I mean, I think they've got a very interesting franchise in the wealth management space. They're absolutely the global powerhouse there. That should fare them very well. They've got a strong asset management business. They're pretty good in investment banking. The area that I think has always been a bit slow for UBS over some years has basically been sort of the Swiss domestic business, the Swiss domestic corporate banking and retail banking side of things, which hasn't been terribly exciting. It's just sort of plodded along. But I think with the merger with Credit Suisse, as that basically gets digested and they drive out the cost savings that they're able to generate from that, they should be on a very, very good path for the next few years. So I'm very optimistic about UBS. I think the CEO has basically showed that he's willing to make the necessary cuts that basically Credit Suisse merger and acquisition allows them to do. So there might have been some reluctance to do that because it means a fair number of layoffs within the Swiss market, and that's always politically very unpopular. But I think that's the direction he's going in and pushing quite hard. So UBS over the next couple of years, I think, should be able to bring its cost base down quite substantially, and we should see that bank flourish, I think, over the next few years. So I think that's going to be one of the highlights over the next few years is going to be UBS.
Octavio, let's talk about the US because we've got numbers rolling out later on, the likes of JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Citi first up. We know it's been an interesting window where a little bit of activity has bounced back on the investment banking side. But that said, commercial real estate, the woes we continue to see with the higher for longer scenario. I was reading a stat, 50% of all debt backing office real estate, non-residential properties is sitting with the banks. What do you expect as a result this quarter for the banks?
Well, listen, I'm much more optimistic than most people are about this quarter for the US banks. I think right across the board, if you look at overall lending activities up, we talked about net interest margin. That's been under pressure over the course of the past few quarters. I think that's basically run its course now. So we're going to see that more or less flatlining. Delinquency rates remain very, very low. So if you look at the delinquency rates on commercial real estate or other mortgages, credit cards, even at the top banks in any case, remain very, very low. I mean, they've inched up a slight bit, but not that much. And I think the real risk is now that the banks come and say, well, we have to put a lot of money aside in terms of provisioning for future credit losses. But the US economy is doing really, really well. And usually what drives those provisions are two things, two factors, is GDP growth and unemployment. And when unemployment goes up and GDP growth goes down, the bank said, okay, we're going to have future problems. Let's set aside some cash in reserves. That's not happening this time. Unemployment remains very low. That's one of the most important factors in determining what your credit loss reserves are. And that looks really good. So I think across the board, we should see pretty good growth in the US banking sector. Wells Fargo and Citibank this morning are going to be a couple of exceptions. Citibank's going through this massive restructuring, and that's going to weigh on costs. So I would expect to see a whole bunch of costs associated with that. And Wells Fargo, much more than any of the other large banks, has a big exposure to mortgage lending, and that's been fairly soft over the course of the past year. But I would say I'm expecting to see JP Morgan actually advance its earnings. I don't know what they're going to do with credit losses. That could bring it down. But I think overall, it should look very, very good.
Octavio, succession planning, clearly a feature too on Wall Street as we see new CEOs over at Morgan Stanley and Lazard. But you also pinpoint JP Morgan and put some question marks around the future of Jamie Dimon and politics. I thought it was interesting, given it was just a couple of days ago we heard about successes to Jamie Dimon down the track. Just flesh out where you think his future lies.
Well, I really don't know. He hasn't told me what he's planning on doing yet. But reading his letter to the shareholders, which all of Wall Street goes through very carefully, I was sort of surprised. It didn't really sound like a letter to shareholders from a bank CEO, but rather sort of like a political manifesto, where he's talking about America's role in the world and international politics and foreign relations, and we must come together to fight the good fight and things of that sort. So it seemed to me that he was preparing himself for something else other than being a bank CEO. Now, obviously, he's been there at the helm for 20 years now. He's done a fantastic job and is probably looking to move on to the next thing. I suppose he's getting a bit old to be a bank CEO, but very, very young to be a US president. So maybe that's the direction he's looking at.
Brilliant. Love your comments, Octavio. Thank you so much, Dave, for joining Karen and I. It'd be nice to see you around the desk at some stage, if you can make it. Lovely to see you. Octavio Morenzi, CEO of OPIMAS. On a programming note, Nate, our US colleagues will speak to the BlackRock chair and CEO Larry Fink later today. That is the first on CNBC interview, and it is coming up, Arabella, at 1500 Central European time.
Well, what else is coming up on the show? Amazon CEO Andy Jassy telling CNBC the company is committed to cutting costs, but they will be investing in artificial intelligence. We'll bring you that interview. It's coming up next. Also, former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, he's set to unveil his long-awaited review into the Bank of England's forecasting models. We'll have more on that later this hour. And later today, we then get to speak to the World Bank's Managing Director, that's Axel von Trotzberg. That's ahead of next week's IMF World Bank Spring Meetings in Washington. That's coming up at 9:30 CET.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva warned central bankers against cutting rates too soon, adding a premature easing could cause inflation spikes. The IMF chief said a downward trend in inflation is expected to continue this year, but stressed price pressures still remain. Georgieva also urged fresh measures to boost productivity and lower debt burdens, warning that the global economy could face a decade of weak growth that she dubbed the, quote, tepid 20s. Speaking to CNBC, Georgieva said the US economy is in a strong position, adding that the Fed will likely be cautious on interest rates.
The Fed is going to be watchful, and it's not going to be in a hurry. But let's be more optimistic around the future, because the US is not affected by what is happening in some other economies, pressure for increase of labor cost. This is mostly due to the fact that the labor supply in the U.S. has been quite strong. And also the U.S. Government is in a position to play a somewhat bigger role in making sure the economy doesn't overheat. From where I sit, the fact that the U.S. economy is strong is good news for the U.S., good news for the world economy. But if interest rates were to be prolonged at a high level much more than we initially anticipated, that can create risks for financial stability for the rest of the world.
The IMF chief also touched on China, urging authorities to do more to improve its economic prospects.
The Chinese economy does need to shift to a different type of growth. We have been recommending and will continue to do so to focus more on domestic demand. And that means three things. One, fix the property sector. They have taken some action, but in our view, more is necessary. And why is this important? Because for many Chinese, their property ownership is their pension, it is their security. So when the price of real estate goes down, people spend less because they worry that they're losing that security. Second, we are very keen to see more attention to social safety nets So again, to boost consumer confidence and to see more domestic demand. And third, China does have some space to pursue the reforms of state-owned enterprises, bring down local government debt, get more attention to the functioning of the markets, be genuinely market-based economy, let market forces work harder for them. And if they do that, if they pursue a course of reforms, they can actually boost output for the next couple of years up to 18%. That would help China. It would also help China to sustain its role in Asia as a source of growth.
Kristalina Georgieva there, and we are waiting out for Chinese trade figures to cross over the next course of time. Been waiting for a while, actually, most of the morning for the numbers. Let's push on to Apple. Shares saw their best days since May amid wider tech sector gains and expectations that the firm will make a major AI announcement later this year. Apple is reportedly also planning to overhaul its entire Mac lineup with new AI-focused chips. And that's according to Bloomberg, which says the company is already nearing production of its brand new M4 processor just months after it released computers with the M3 chip. And of course, that's fascinating if we see AI on device with Apple. Amazon shares closed at a record high, extending a six-month rally and surpassing its previous peak in July 2021. This is the CEO, Andy Jassy, said the company is committed to cutting down costs while still investing in new growth areas like AI. In his annual letter to shareholders, Jassy said AI will be the company's next, quote, big primitive service. This is an area of which business which could spur new projects and investments. Interesting terminology, isn't it? That they're talking about. I think we're effectively a new pillar for growth is what they're suggesting.
Can it be what AWS was? I'm not convinced. I think it can be a great tool.
I think that's what they're hoping.
Yeah, but as a standalone, whereas AWS clearly is the engine behind a lot of online businesses. It's brilliant. And it was like the open secret for so many years about the growth behind Amazon. But can AI be a standalone? I don't
possibly
see how it can be a standalone.
Given all the use cases are just coming through, so possibly. Well, Jassy told our US colleagues that AI will be among the technologies that could disrupt Amazon's business.
AI is going to transform every customer experience that we know. We think there are three big macro areas of the generative AI stack, each of which are gigantic and each of which we're investing deeply in. And, you know, I think of it as at the lowest layer, are for people that are building their own large language models. And the two things that really matter there is the compute to train the model and to run the predictions of the inferences. And what matters in that is the chip.
Right.
And then the services that you have to actually build models. And we've got very significant investments there. Most of the early AI models have been built by NVIDIA, but supply is more scarce and people are concerned about cost. And so we've built our own custom silicon in AI. We've built a training chip called Trainium and an inference chip called Inferentia that are meaningfully more price performant than what you can find out there. So a lot of the training, a lot of the predictions are going to be done on those chips. And and then I would say at that middle layer of the stack are for people that are going to actually leverage somebody else's model, but customize it with their own data and then use our features to make it easy as a service. And we built the service called Bedrock. And a lot of the generative AI applications are being built on top of Bedrock because it's the easiest way to build a high-quality generative AI application. Then there's the applications of which, you know, we're building a lot of them ourselves, but the vast majority of those will be built by third parties.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to CNBC.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.